Mostly we never saw the enemy close up. They were always just flecks of light on the horizon, or through our infrared overlay. Always ghosts, reflecting back the light of sun and earth, like the moon itself. It made it easier to kill them, if I'm being honest. They already seemed dead. When you're beyond Chandnipur, out on the Mara under the merciless black sky, with the earth gleaming in the distance, the only color you can see anywhere. It felt like we were already dead too. Like we were all just ghosts, playing out the old wars of humanity. Ghosts of soldiers who died far, far down on the ground. But then we'd return to the city, to the warm bustle of the underground markets on our days off, to our Chota Dunia. And the earth would seem like heaven again. Not a world left behind, but one to be attained, one to earn the unattainable paradise, rather than a distant history of life that we'd only lived through media pods and lessons. And now, here you are, on Earth. Here I am. Paradise attained. I have died and gone to heaven. It's why I'm here, isn't it? Why we're talking. You could say that. Thank you for coming again. You didn't have any trouble coming up the elevator shaft, did you? I know it's rough clinging to the top of the elevator. I've been on rougher rides. There are plenty of touts down in the elevator bay station who are more than willing to give someone with a few rupees a lending hand up the spindle. So, you were saying? About coming back to Earth. It must have been surprising, the news that you were coming back last year. FTL changed everything. That was what, 9 years ago? At first, it brought us to the edge of full-on lunar war, like never before, because the moon became the greatest of all jewels in the night sky. It could become our first FTL port. Everyone wanted a stake in that. Every national territory on the moon closed off its borders while the Earth governments negotiated. We were closed off in our bunkers, looking at the stars through the small windows, eating nothing but thin parathas from emergency flour rations. We made them on our personal heating coils with Sinthi butter. No food was coming through because of embargo. Mess halls in the main barracks were empty. We lived on those parathas and caffeine infusion. Our stomachs were like balloons, full of air. Things escalated like never before in that time. I remember a direct Chinese attack on Chandnipur's outer defenses, where we were stationed. One bunker window was taken out by laser. I saw a man stuck to the molten hole in the pane because of depressurization, wriggling like a dying insect. Asur Jatayu, a quiet, skinny soldier with a drinking problem. People always said he filled his suits drinking water pods with diluted moonshine from the underground markets and sucked it down during patrols. I don't know if that's true, but people didn't trust him because of it, even though he never really did anything to fuck things up. He was stone cold sober that day. I know, because I was with him. Aditi, me, and two other Asuras ripped him off the broken window, activated the emergency shutter before we lost too much pressure. But he'd already hemorrhaged severely through the laser wound, which had blown blood out of him and into the thin air of the moon. He was dead. The Chinese had already retreated by the time we recovered. It was a direct response to our own overtures before the embargo. We had destroyed some nanobot anchors of theirs in disputed territory, which had been laid down to expand the microatmosphere of Yueliang lunar area. That same tech, that keeps air over Chandnipur and other lunar territories enables the microatmospheres, is what makes FTL work, the Q nanobots. On our final patrols across the Mara, we saw some of the new FTL shipyards in the distance. The ships, half-built. They looked like the earth ruins from historical pictures of palaces and cities. We felt like we were looking at artifacts of a civilization from the future. They sparkled like a far-off battle, bots building them tirelessly. They will sail out to outer space, wearing Quen bots around them like cloaks. Like the superheroes. The Quenbot cloud folds the space around the ship like a blanket, makes a bubble that shoots through the universe. I don't really understand. Is it like a soda bubble or a blanket? We had no idea our time on the moon was almost over on those patrols, looking at the early shipyards. After one of the patrols near the shipyards, Asura Aditi turned to me and said, "We'll be on one of those ships one day, sailing to other parts of the galaxy. They'll need us to defend Mother India when she sets her dainty feet on new worlds. Maybe we'll be able to see Jupiter and Saturn and Neptune zoom by like cricket balls, the Milky Way spinning far behind us like a chakra." "I don't think that's quite how FTL works," I told her. But obviously she knew that. She looked at me. Low dawn sunlight on her visor, so I couldn't see her face. Even though this patrol was during a temporary ceasefire, she had painted her face like she so loved to, so all you could see anyway were the whites of her eyes and her teeth. Kali Ma through and through, just like you said. "Just imagine, maybe we'll end up on a world where we can breathe everywhere. Where there are forests and running water and deserts like Earth. Like in the old Bollywood movies, where the heroes and the heroines run around trees and splash in water like foolish children with those huge mountains behind them covered in ice." "Arre, you can get all that on Earth. It's where those movies come from. Why would you want to go further away from Earth? You don't want to return home." "That's a nice idea, Geeta," she said. "But the longer we are here, and the more news and movies and feeds I see of Earth, I get the idea it's not really waiting for us." That made me angry, though I didn't show it. "We've waited all our lives to go back, and now you want to toss off to another world?" I asked, as if we had a choice in the matter. The two of us, since we were children in the juvenile barracks, had talked about moving to a little house in the Himalayas once we went back. Somewhere in Sikkim or northern Bengal. We learned all the states as children and saw their flags along New Delhi Avenue. Where it's not as crowded as the rest of Earth still. And we could see those famously huge mountains that dwarfed the moon's arid hills. She said, "Hi Ram, I'm just dreaming like we always have. My dear, what you're not getting is that we have seen Earth on the feeds since we came to the moon. From expectation, there is only disappointment." So I told her, "When you talk about other worlds out there, you realize those are expectations too. You are forgetting we are soldiers. We go to Earth. It means our battle is over. We go to another world? You think they'd let us frolic like Bollywood stars in alien streams? Just you and me, Geeta and Aditi, with the rest of our division doing backup dancing?" I couldn't stay angry when I thought of this, though I still felt a bit hurt that she was suggesting she didn't want to go back to Earth with me, like the sisters in arms we were. "True enough," she said. "Such a literalist. If our mission is ever to play Bollywood on an exoplanet, you can play the man hero with your lovely rat-tail beard. Anyway, for now all we have is this grey rock, where all the ice is underneath us instead of prettily on the mountains. Not earth or any other tarty rival to it. This is home, Geeta beta, don't forget it. How right she was. Then came peacetime. We saw the protests on earth feeds. People marching through the vast cities. More people than we'd ever see in a lifetime in Chandnipur, with signs and chants. No more military presence on the moon. The moon is not an army base. Bring back our soldiers. The moon is not a battlefield. But it was. That's the thing. We had seen our fellow Asuras die on it. With the creation of the Terran Union of Spacefaring Nations, TUSN, in anticipation of human expansion to extrasolar space, India finally gave up its sovereignty over Chandnipur, which became just one settlement in amalgamated TUSN lunar territory. There were walled-off nuclear seclusion zones up there on Earth, still hot from the last World War, and somehow they'd figured out how to stop war on the moon. With the signing of the International Lunar Peace Treaty, every nation that had held its own patch of the moon for a century of settlement on the satellite agreed to lay down their arms under Earth, Sol, the gods, the goddesses, and the god. The moon was going to be free of military presence for the first time in decades. When us Asuras were first told officially of the decommissioning of Lunar Command in Chandnipur, we celebrated. We'd made it. We were going to Earth, earlier than we'd ever thought, long before retirement age. Even our CEOs got shit-faced in the mess halls. There were huge tubs of biryani, with hot chunks of printed lamb and gobs of Sinthi dalda. We ate so much, I thought we'd explode. Even Aditi, who'd been dreaming about other worlds, couldn't hold back her happiness. She asked me, "What's the first thing you're going to do on Earth?" Her face covered in grease, making me think of her as a child with another name, grubby cheeks covered in syrup from stolen jalebis. "I'm going to catch a train to a riverside beach or a seawall and watch the movement of water on a planet. Water, flowing and thrashing for kilometers and kilometers, stretching all the way to the horizon. I'm going to fall asleep to it. Then I'm going to go to all the restaurants and eat all the real foods that the fake food in the underground markets is based on. Don't spend all your money in one day, okay? We need to save up for that house in the Himalayas." "You're going to go straight to the mountains, aren't you?" I said with a smile. "Nah, I'll wait for you first, beta. What do you think?" "Good girl." After that meal, a handful of us went out with our suits for an unscheduled patrol for the first time. I guess you'd call it a moonwalk at that point. We saluted the Earth together, on a lunar surface, where we had no threat of being silently attacked from all sides. The century-long lunar Cold War was over. It had cooled, frozen, bubbled, boiled at times. But now it had evaporated. We were all to go to our paradise in the black sky, as we had wished every day on our dreary Chota Dunia. We didn't stop to think what it all really meant for us Asuras, of course. Because as Aditi had told me, the moon was our home. The only one we'd ever known, really. It is a strange thing to live your life in a place that was never meant for human habitation. You grow to loathe such a life. The gritty dust in everything from your food to your teeth to your weapons, despite extensive air filters, the bitter aerosol meds to get rid of infections and nosebleeds from it, spending half of your days exercising and drinking carefully rationed water so your body doesn't shrivel up in sub-earth grav or dry out to a husk in the dry, scrubbed air of controlled atmospheres. The deadening beauty of grey horizons, with not a hint of water or life or vegetation in sight, except for the sharp lines and lights of human settlement, which we compared so unfavorably to the dazzling technicolor of images and video feeds from Earth, the richness of its life and variety. The constant, relentless company of the same people you grow to love with such ferocity that you hate them as well, because there is no one else for company but the occasional civilian who has the courage to talk to a soldier in Chandnipur's streets, tunnels, and canteens. Now the moon is truly a gateway to the stars. It is pregnant with the vessels that will take humanity to them, with shipyards and ports rising up under the limbs of robots. I look up at our Chota Dunya, and its face is crusted in lights, a crown given to her by her lover. Like a goddess, it'll birth humanity's new children. We were born in the sky for war. But we weren't, in truth. We were asuras. Now they will be devas, devis. They will truly be like gods with FTL. In Chandnipur, they told us that we must put our faith in Bhagavan, in all the gods and goddesses of the pantheon. We were given a visiting room, where we sat in the VR pods and talked directly to their avatars, animated by the machines. That was the only VR we were allowed. No Sims of Earth or anything like that. Maybe because they didn't want us to get too distracted from our lives on the moon. So we talked to the avatars, dutifully, in those pods with their smell of incense. Every week we asked them to keep us alive on Chota Dunya, this place where humanity should not be, and yet is. And now we might take other worlds, large and small. Does that frighten you? I don't know. You told us all those years ago, and you tell me now, that we asuras looked like gods and superheroes when you saw us, in our suits, which would nearly crush a human with their weight if anyone wore them on Earth, let alone walked or fought in them. And now, imagine the humans who will go out there into the star-lit darkness. The big ships won't be ready for a long time. But the small ones, they already want volunteers to take one-way test trips to exoplanets. I don't doubt some of those volunteers will come from the streets, like us asuras. They need people who don't have anything on Earth, so they can leave it behind and spend their lives in the sky. They will travel faster than light itself. Impossible made possible. Even the asuras of the Lunar Command were impossible once. The moon was a lifeless place, nothing but rock and mineral and water. And we still found a way to bring war to it. We still found a way to fight there. Now, when the new humans set foot on other worlds, what if there is life there? What if there is God-given life that has learned to tell stories, make art, fight, and love? Will we bring an Earth army to that life, whatever form it takes? Will we send out this new humanity to discover and share? Or will we take people like me and Aditi, born in the streets with nothing, and give them a suit of armor and a ship that sails across the cosmos faster than the light of stars, and send them out to conquer? In the myths, asuras can be both benevolent or evil, like gods or demons. If we have the chariots of the gods at our disposal, what use is there for gods? What if the next soldiers who go forth into space become demons with the power of gods? What if envy strikes their hearts and they take fertile worlds from other life forms by force? What if we bring war to a peaceful cosmos? At least we Asuras only killed other humans. One could argue that you didn't just fight on the moon. You brought life there for the first time. We loved there as well. We still do. There are still humans there. Love. I've never heard anyone tell me they love me, nor told anyone I love them. People on Earth, if you trust the stories, say it all the time. We Asuras didn't really know what the word meant in the end. But I did love, didn't I? I loved my fellow soldiers. I would have given my life for them. That must be what it means. I loved Aditi. That is the first time I've ever said that. I loved Aditi, my sister in arms. I wonder what she would have been if she had stayed on Earth, never been adopted by the Indian government and given to the army. A dancer? A Bollywood star? They don't like women with muscles like her, do they? She was bloody graceful with a jetpack, I'll tell you that much. And then, when I actually stop to think, I realize that she would have been a beggar or a sweeper or a sewer scraper if the army hadn't given us to the sky, like me. Now I live among beggars, garbage pickers and sweepers and sewer scrapers in this slum clinging to what they call the pillar to heaven. To heaven! Can you believe that? Just like we called Earth heaven up there. These people here, they take care of me. In them, I see a shared destiny. What is that? To remind us that we are not the gods. This is why I pray still to the gods, or the one God, whatever is out there beyond the heliosphere. I pray that the humans who will sail past light and into the rest of the universe find grace out there. Find a way to bring us closer to godliness, to worlds where we might start anew and have no need for soldiers to fight, only warriors to defend against dangers that they themselves are not the harbingers of. To worlds where our cities have no slums filled with people whose backs are bent with the bravery required to hold up the rest of humanity. Can I ask something? How did Asura Aditi die? Asura Aditi of the 8th Lunar Division, Chandnipur, Indian Armed Forces, survived 34 years of life and active combat duty as a soldier on the moon, to be decommissioned and allowed to return to planet Earth. And then she died right here in New Delhi megapolis, walking to the market. We Asuras aren't used to this gravity, to these crowds. One shove from a passing impatient pedestrian is all it takes. She fell down on the street, shattered her moon-brittled hip because when we came here to paradise, we found that treatment and physio for our weakened bodies takes money that our government does not provide. We get a pension, but it's not much. We have to choose food and rent or treatment. There is no cure. We might have been bred for war in the sky, but we were not bred for life on Earth. Why do you think there are so few volunteers for the Asura program? They must depend on the children of those who have nothing. Aditi fell to Earth from the moon and broke. She didn't have money for a fancy private hospital. She died of an infection in a government hospital. She never did see the Himalayas. Nor have I. I'm sorry. I live here, in the slums around Akash Mahal Space Elevator Shaft, because of Aditi. It's dangerous living along the spindle, but it's cheaper than the subsidized rent of the veterans' arcologies. And I like the danger. I was a soldier after all. I like living by the stairway to the sky, where I once lived. I like being high up here, where the wind blows like it never did on the moon's gray deserts, where the birds I never saw now fly past me every morning and warm my heart with their cries. I like the sound of the nanotube ecosystem all around us, digesting all our shit and piss and garbage, turning it into the light in my one bulb, the heat in my one stove coil, the water from my pipes, piggybacking on the charge from the solar panels that power my little feed terminal. The way the walls pulse, absorbing sound and kinetic energy when the elevator passes back and forth, the rumble of Space Elevator Garuda 3 through the spindle all the way to the top of the atmosphere. I don't like the constant smell of human waste. I don't like wondering when the police will decide to cast off the blinders and destroy this entire slum because it's illegal. I don't like going with a half-empty stomach all the time, living off the kindness of the little ones here who go up and down all the time and get my flour and rice. But I'm used to such things. Chandnipur was not a place of plenty either. I like the way everyone takes care of each other here. We have to, or the entire slum will collapse like a rotten vine slipping off a tree trunk. We depend on each other for survival. It reminds me of my past life. And I save the money from my pension, little by little, by living frugally, to one day buy a basic black market exoskeleton to assist me and get basic treatment, physio, to learn how to walk and move like a human on Earth. Can I help in any way? You have helped by listening. Maybe you can help others listen as well, as you've said. Maybe they'll heed the words of a veteran forced to live in a slum. If they send soldiers to the edge of the galaxy, I can only hope that they will give those soldiers a choice this time. I beg the ones who prepare our great chariots. If you must take our soldiers with you, take them. Their courage, their resilience, their loyalty will serve you well on a new frontier. But do not take war to new worlds. War belongs here on Earth. I should know. I've fought it on the moon, and it didn't make her happy. In her cold anger, she turned our bodies to glass. Our chota dunya was not meant to carry life, but we thrust it into her anyway. Let us not make that mistake again. Let us not violate the more welcoming worlds we may find, seeing their beauty as acquiescence. With FTL, there will be no end to humanity's journey. If we keep going far enough, perhaps we will find the gods themselves waiting behind the veil of the universe. And if we do not come in peace by then, I fear we will not survive the encounter. I clamber down the side of the column of the space elevator, winding down through the biohomes of the slum, towards one of the tunnels where I can reach the internal shaft and wait for the elevator on the way down. Once it's close to the surface of the planet, it slows down a lot. That's when people jump on to hitch a ride up or down. We're only about 1,000 feet up, so it's not too long a ride down. But the wait for it could be much longer. The insides of the shaft are always lined with slum dwellers and elevator station hawkers, rigged with gas masks and cling clothes, hanging on to the nano cable cords and sinews of the great spindle. I might just catch a ride on the back of one of the gliders who offer their solar wings to travelers looking for a quick trip back to the ground. Bit more terrifying, but technically less dangerous if their back harness and propulsion works. The 8-year-old boy guiding me down through the steep slum along the pipes and vines of the NGO-funded nano ecosystem occasionally looks up at me with a gap-toothed smile. "I want to be an asura like Gita," he says. "I want to go to the stars." "Aren't you afraid of not being able to walk properly when you come back to Earth?" "Who said I want to come back to Earth?" I smile and look up, past the fluttering prayer flags of drying clothes, the pulsing wall of the slum, at the dizzying stairway to heaven, an infinite line receding into the blue. At the edge of the spindle, I see Asura Gita poised between the air and her home, leaning precariously out to wave goodbye to me. Her hair ripples out against the sky, a smudge of black. A late evening moon hovers full and pale above her head, twinkling with lights. I wave back, overcome with vertigo. She seems about to fall, but she doesn't. She is caught between the earth and the sky in that moment, forever.
Every Hour of Light and Dark by Nancy Kress. The year 1668. Delft, shrouded in rain, was uniformly gray. Hunched against the cold and wet, the artist walked from Oude Longendijk along the canal to his patron's house. Much as he hated this sort of occasion, inside the house would be warmth, food, wine, and quiet. His own house, crowded with children, was never quiet. "You are welcome," said his patron's wife shyly as a servant took his cloak. "Peter will be glad to see you." Johannes doubted that. This celebration was not about him, nor one of his paintings, nor even the newly acquired Maas painting being shown for the first time. This celebration was about the patron, his wealth, his taste, his power. Johannes smiled at his pretty wife, another acquisition, and passed into the first of many lavishly furnished rooms, all warm from good fires. In this room hung one of his own paintings. Johannes glanced at it in passing, then stopped abruptly. His eyes widened. He took a candle from a table and held it close to the picture. Ladies sewing a child's bonnet. He had painted it 4 years ago. Katharina had been the model. She sat, heavily pregnant, on a wooden chair, the light from an unseen window illuminating the top of her fair hair as she bent over her work. A broken toy lay at her feet, and what could be seen of her expression was somber. On the table beside her were her workbasket, a glass of wine, and a pearl necklace, tossed carelessly, as if she had thrown it off in discomfort or despair. On the wall behind her was a painting within a painting, von Hontorst's Lute Player. The painstaking detail in the smaller picture, the hint of underpainted blue in Katharina's burgundy-colored dress, the warm light on the whitewashed walls, how long it took to get that right, all shone in the glow from Johannes's candle. But he had not made this painting. Inch by inch he examined it, ignoring guests who passed him, spoke to him. Ladies sewing a child's bonnet was the most skillful forgery he had ever seen, but forgery it was. Did Peter know? Presumably not, or the picture would not still be on the patron's walls. How had it come there? Who had painted it? And what should Johannes do about this? The decision came swiftly. He should do nothing. He owed money all over the city. He had hopes of Peter's commissioning another painting from him soon, perhaps tonight. The original could not have been switched with the forgery without Peter's consent, not in this well-guarded house. And Peter would not welcome attention drawn to whatever scheme he was participating in. Say nothing.
"Ah, Johannes," said a booming voice behind him. "Admiring your own work, you vain man."
Johannes turned to face the guest of honor, Nicholas Mass.
"No," he said. Mass waited, but Johannes said nothing more. Not now, not ever.
The year 2270. Cran is working on clearances at his console when Tullia bounces into the project room.
"Cran, they chose it. They really chose it."
She grabs his hands and twirls him in circles.
Careful. You'll hit the squares.
She stops moving and drops Cran's hands. He hears his own tone, sour, disapproving, a cranky old man. He sees that Tullia understands immediately, but understanding isn't enough to erase the hurt. Torn between them, she chooses hurt.
"Aren't you happy for me?"
"Of course I am," he says, and forces a smile. And he is happy in a way. How could he not be? Tullia is him, or at least 32% of her genes are. It's the other 68% that prompts this terrible, inexcusable jealousy. She says softly,
"Maybe next cycle the gallery will choose one of your pictures."
It is the wrong thing to say. They both know that will never happen. Cran does not have Tullia's talent, has perhaps no talent at all. How does she do it, produce art that is somehow fresh and arresting after working all day at the project's forgeries? How? Sometimes he hates her for it. Does she know this? Sometimes he loves her for it. She knows this. Cran says,
"I'm happy for you, but I need to work."
Her eyes sharpen. She, after all, is part of the project.
"Do you have something?"
"An ancient Egyptian vase on square 3. Go look."
She looks, frowning.
"We cannot reproduce that."
"Doesn't matter. It's inside a tomb. We can transfer a lump of rock and no one would ever know. We could transfer one of my sculptures, which are just as dreadful as my paintings."
"The tomb was never opened before."
"No.
No one ever names the madness, if naming can be avoided. Even in a deliberately rational society, legally rational, culturally rational, genetically rational, to whatever extent the geneticists can manage, superstitions seep in like moon dust in airlocks. No one says the word aloud."
"Well, that's wonderful," Tullia says. "Has the director vetted it? Have you done the clearances?"
"Yes, he did, and I'm completing them now." When is your gallery presentation?"
"Tuesday. I'll go now. I just wanted to tell you about my painting."
"I'm glad you did,"
Cran says, lying, hoping she doesn't realize that. 68% foreign genes. Tullia leaves. Cran de-opaques the window wall and stares out. The project is housed in its own dome, and sometimes the bleak lunar landscape calms him when he feels especially bleak. Not, however, this time. On the horizon, the lights of Alpha Dome are just visible below stars in the black sky. Alpha was the first, the only dome to exist when the madness happened on Earth. 6,000 lunar colonists, half of them scientists. They had the best equipment, the best scientific minds, the best planners. Earth had those who could not qualify. Earth had too many people and too many wars. Earth had the ability to create genetically boosted bioweapons so powerful that when the madness began as just another war, it quickly escalated. In 3 months, everyone on Earth was dead. How could they do that, those Terrans of 2 centuries ago? Those on Alpha watched in horror. There was nothing they could do except what they did, shoot down both incoming missiles and incoming infected escapees. He was not there, of course. He's old, but not that old. How long does it take for guilt to evaporate? Longer than 200 years. Alpha Dome grew to 16 more domes. If he squints hard, he might be able to see the robots constructing Sigma Dome on the western horizon, or the sprays of dirt thrown up from the borers digging the connecting tunnels. But through all the construction, all the genetic tinkering, all the amazing scientific progress, the guilt has not gone away. We humans murdered our own species. Thus, the project. Or perhaps Cran thinks that's wrong. There is, after all, a strong but polite political faction. All of Luna's political factions are polite, or else they don't exist. That says the project should be discontinued and its resources committed to the present and the future, not to rescuing the past. So far, this has not happened. It takes Cran nearly an hour to finish the complicated clearance procedures for the Egyptian vase. He finds it hard to concentrate. The clearances are approved almost immediately. They are, after all, only a formality. The director, who is the project's expert on art of the ancient world, has already inspected the image glowing in Square 3. Cran has worked a long day, and it's late. He should go home. But he likes working alone at night, and he has the seniority to do so. He gazes at the vase, this exquisite thing that exists in dark beneath tons of rock in a buried tomb 250,000 miles and 3 millennia away. A core-formed glass vessel, 3 inches high. Its graceful, elaborately decorated curves once held perfumed ointment or scented oils. Perhaps it still does. The project room is lined with squares, each a 6-foot cube. Some of the squares are solid, real-time alloys. Some are virtual simulations. Some are not actually there at all, not in time or space. The project is built on chaos theory, which says that the patterns of space-time contain something called strange attractors, a mathematical concept that Cran doesn't understand at all. He is, after all, a project technician, not a physicist, a senior, trusted technician who will never be an artist. Why Tullia? Why not me? One of those questions that, like the madness, has no answer. The year 2018. The guard at the National Gallery in Washington, D.C. made his early morning rounds. He unlocked each room, peered in, and moved on. He had worked there a long while and prided himself on knowing exactly what each exhibit held at any given time. He unlocked a gallery, glanced in, and stopped cold. Not possible. This room held the gallery's 5 Vermeers. At present, 2 were on loan. The other 3 should be on the off-white walls in their protected frames. They were. But... Oh, my God, the guard said under his breath, and then very loudly. His hands shook as he pressed the alarm on his pager. 2270. The transfer happens, as always, blindingly fast. One moment, Square 3 holds a small stone. The next, it holds a delicate purple vase, trimmed in gold. Cran doesn't touch it. He follows protocol and calls 2 members of the handler staff. Despite the hour, they both rush to the project's room. Marbert Hammerling's eyes water, an extravagance that Cran deplores even as he understands it. Salvaging anything from the past is a slow, difficult, emotional triumph. Humanity's artistic heritage lay decaying on a deserted and contaminated earth. Nothing can be brought from the present without bringing contamination with it. But thanks to the genius of the Ravelli equations, and the engineers who translated them to reality, some things can be saved from the past. Only things less than 6 cubic feet. Only things deemed worthy of the huge expenditure of energy. Only things non-living. Only things replaced in transfer by a rough equivalent in weight and size. Only replacements that will not change the course of the time stream that has already unfolded. Otherwise, the transfer simply did not happen. The past could only be disturbed so much. Marbot whispers, "It is so beautiful." Reverently, she lifts it from the faint shimmer of the square. Cran is permitted to touch it with one finger, briefly. Only that. The vase will go into the gallery, and thousands will come to view and glory in this rightful human inheritance. The handlers bear away the vase. Cran paces the project room. It's well into the artificial lunar night. The lights of Alpha Dome have dimmed on the horizon. Cran can't sleep. It's been several nights since he slept. He's old, but it isn't that. Desire consumes him. The desire of a young man, not for sex, but for glory. Once he thought he would be a great artist. Long ago, reality killed the dream, but not the gnawing disappointment, eating at his innards, his brain, his heart. Tullia has a painting chosen for the gallery. His own work is shit, has always been shit, will always be shit. Tullia, people are beginning to say, is the real thing, a genuine artist, the kind that comes along once in a generation. Cran can't sit still, can't sleep, can't lift himself yet again from the black pit into which he falls so often. Only one thing helps, and he has long since gotten past any qualms about its legality. He takes the pill and waits. 10 minutes later, nothing matters so much. Not even his inadequacy. His brain has been temporarily rewired. Nothing works optimally, either, including his hands and his brain, both of which tremble. Small price to pay. The gnawing grows less. The pit retreats. A flash of color catches his eye. Square 2 lights up. The endlessly scanning project has found something. 2018. How? James Glenwood said, and then, is anything missing? Of the National's 5 Vermeers, Girl with a Flute and Girl with a Red Hat were on loan to the Frick in New York. Woman Holding a Balance and Lady Writing both hung on the walls. So did Lady Sewing a Child's Bonnet. Below that, propped against the wall in a room locked all night, sat its duplicate. A fake, of course, but how the hell did it get there? The guard looked guilty. But Henry had worked for the museum for 25 years, and naturally he looked upset. Suspicion was bound to fall on him as the person who locked this room last night and opened it this morning. Glenwood, a curator for 30 years, remembered well the 1990 brazen theft of Vermeer's The Concert from the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. The picture had never been recovered. Except this was not a theft. A prank? A warning of thefts to come? Look how easily I can break into this place. Every other room in the National would now have to be meticulously checked, and every work of art. Security would have to be reviewed. The police must be called, and the director. The curator pulled out his phone. Only, phone in hand, he knelt in front of the painting that had so mysteriously appeared. Glenwood had studied 17th-century art his entire life. He had thousands and thousands of hours of experience, honed to an intuition that had often proved more correct than reason. He studied the picture propped against the wall, and then the one above it. His cell hung limply at his side, and a deep line crinkled his forehead. Something here was not right. 2270. Cran has never seen anything like the picture whose image floats in square 2. The squares seem to capture more three-dimensional objects than paintings, and only 11 have been transferred since the project began. 3 Picassos, 2 medieval pictures that ignore perspective, 2 abstracts that seem to him nothing but blobs of paint, a Monet, a Renoir, a Takashi Murakami, and a faded triptych from some Italian church. None of them are like this. The light, It falls on the figure, a woman bent over some sort of sewing. It glows on her burgundy gown, on the walls, on a pearl necklace lying on a table. Almost it outshines the soft glow of the square itself. The woman seems sad, and so real she makes Cran's heart ache. He stares at the picture for a long time, his mind befuddled by the drug he's taken, but his heart loud and clear. He must have this picture. Not the gallery, him, for himself. Not possible. Unless... He stumbles to his console and says, "Forgeries by Tullia Anson. Complete catalog, visual at 10-second intervals." The screen, not a square, just a normal hollow screen, flashes the forgeries that Tula has completed so far. Each awaits a square's tracking the original somewhere in time. The catalog is not random. Curators and physicists have collaborated to estimate what periods and artworks have the greatest chance of appearing in the squares. Cran does not, and has never tried, to understand the equations involved, those mysterious mathematical convolutions that make strange attractors out of chaos. He only knows that these are the pictures most likely to appear. Several landscapes in various styles appear and disappear on the screen, some portraits, more hideous abstracts. Tullia, the project's best forger, works hard and quickly. A bunch of still lifes, with and without fruit. And then... Stop the catalog! There it is. Lady Sewing a Child's Bonnet by Johannes Reinier Vermeer, 1664. What a mundane name for such perfection. Cran knows this woman. Knows her from the sad tilt of her head, the bonnet she sews for her unborn child, the broken toy at her feet, the pearl necklace she has flung off. He is sure that her unseen eyes are filled with tears. She is deeply unhappy. Her life has not turned out as she hoped. Cran knows her. He is her. How many pills did he take? No matter. This is his painting, meant for him. And Tullia, who is 32% his genes, has completed a superb forgery. That, too, proves that what he is going to do was meant to be. Yes. He does not bother with clearances. Actually, he cannot. There must be no traces. Clean and quick. The universe, which has denied him so much, owes him this. The Vermeer hangs on the silk-covered wall of what looks in the square like a private house, although it's hard to be certain. Vermeer's house? A patron? It doesn't matter. Cran works quickly, calling for a bot to bring Tullia's painting from the storage, erasing the bot's memory record, hoisting the forgery into the square, setting the controls. His hands fumble in their eagerness. It all must be done manually, to leave no record. He makes the transfer. Tullia's forgery vanishes. Nothing appears in square two. Nothing. No! Data flashes on the console below the square. A mechanical voice says calmly, "Error, error, transfer malfunction." And then, "Danger, deactivate this square." No! Cran gasps, unable to breathe. The square blinks on and off, as he has never seen a square blink before. But he knows what this means. Space-time is being affected in what could be a permanent way if the square is not deactivated immediately. Fingers trembling, he enters and speaks the commands. The square goes dark. The console data still glows. Cran stares at it. He shakes his head. Transfer 653. Transfer date, Saturday, decade 28, 2270. Transfer to past. Plan transfer from present to March 16th, 1668. Achieved transfer from present to March 16th, 1668. Status, transfer successful. Transfer to present. Plan transfer from March 16th, 1668 to present. Achieved transfer from March 16, 1668 to unknown time. Status, transfer failed. Reason for failure, incomplete data entry. Clearances 60 through 75. Cran wills the data hollow to change, to say something else. It does not. Because he did not complete the clearances, which were not merely the stupid bureaucracy he had assumed, the transfer has failed. Tullius' forgery has gone to 1668, replacing the original on some silk-covered wall. The real Vermeer has not come all the way forward in time. Where is it? Cran doesn't know. All he knows is that transfers send forgeries to where there is a similar article, which always before has meant the original being brought forward to 2270. That's how the strange attractors formed by the mathematics of chaos theory work. They attract. Only due to Cran's haste, or possibly his intoxicated fumbling, Tullius' forgery has gone to some other attractor of Vermeer's. Are there now two of the paintings on that silk-covered wall in 1668? Or has the original stopped somewhere else in time, snagged on a strange attractor someplace, sometime? He doesn't know. And it doesn't matter where the original has gone. He cannot retrieve it. Cran slumps to the floor. But after a few minutes, he staggers again to his feet. Why did he panic so? No one knows what happened. No one knows why the square malfunctioned. All he has to do is erase the record, a task well within his skills, and report a malfunction. The squares are a machine. Machines break. No one ever has to know. All he has to say is that it spontaneously broke before he made any transfer. That way no one will blame him for an anomaly loose somewhere in the past. Unless someone discovers that Tullia's forgery is missing from storage. But why would they look? The only reason to call up a forgery is if the original appears in a square. Only, he can't think. He is afraid of what he has set loose in the time stream. He needs to get out of here. But he can't, not yet. At his console, he carefully composes a report of spontaneous square malfunction while not engaged in transfer operations. In his mind, he can still see the glowing light of his lost Vermeer. 2018. The two paintings sat on easels at the front of the room. Guards stood outside. All cell phones had been collected and stored in a lockbox. Everyone had been scanned for cameras and voice recorders, a procedure that at least half of those present found insulting. A few said so, loudly. But no one was protesting now. They were too enraptured. Side by side, the two paintings of Lady Sewing a Child's Bonnet looked identical to anyone but a trained observer. Half the people in the room were trained observers, art historians. The other half were forensic scientists. Glenwood listened to one of the scientists' summary of his long-winded analysis. He'd barely looked at the paintings, consulting only his notes. "This painting," he said, gesturing vaguely in the direction of the Vermeer that had hung in the National since being privately donated 16 years ago, "shows aging commensurate with having come from the mid-1600s. As I explained, carbon dating is not particularly accurate when applied to time spans as short as a few hundred years. But the frame, canvas, and pigments in the paint are aged appropriately, and nearly all of them are ones that, you have told me, Vermeer habitually used. That has been verified by both atomic absorption spectrophotometry and pyrolysis gas chromatography mass spectrometry." "Almost all?" Glenwood said. "Some of the pigments are not from Vermeer's historical period?" "No," said the expert from the New York's Met. "But they could have been added later during restoration attempts. After all, the provenance of this painting is clearly documented, and it includes several dealers throughout the centuries, some of whom might have tried to clean or repair the Vermeer for resale.
And of course it has a provenance, which your newcomer does not.
The New York expert had already made her position clear. She thought the newcomer was a clear forgery, and painting number one the real thing. Glenwood was not so sure. He thought scientists and even art experts oversimplified. Really skillful forgeries were notoriously hard to detect, and Vermeer's art had been plagued by imitators. At one point, experts had attributed 70 paintings to him. Today, the number was 34, with more in dispute even under scientific analysis. Vermeer's Young Woman Seated at the Virginals was considered genuine until 1947. A fake from 1947 to 2004, and then genuine again with some disagreement. Science could only go so far. The Crackalure expert spoke next, and scornfully. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen, why we are even here. Painting number one is clearly the real thing. Its pattern of surface cracking is completely in keeping with an age of 354 years, and with the Dutch template of connected networks of cracking. The newcomer has almost no craquelure at all. Furthermore, look how bright and new its colors are. It might have been painted last year. Its total lack of aging tags it as a forgery to anyone actually looking at it. Dr. Glenwood, why are we here? Everyone looked at Glenwood. He pushed down the temper rising in response to the craquelure expert's tone. We are here because I, and not only I, am bothered by other differences between these two paintings. Differences that were not obvious when we had only painting number one and could not compare them side by side. Now we can. Look at the pearl necklace on the second painting. Vermeer painted pearls often, and always they have the sparkle and luster of the second painting, which the first mostly lacks. The second also contains far more tiny detail in the painting within a painting, on the wall behind the woman sewing. That sort of painstaking detail is another Vermeer trademark. Look at the woman's gown. Both versions feature the underpainting in natural ultramarine that Vermeer did beneath his reds to get a purplish tinge. But in painting number two, the result is crisper. And painting number two, I regard this as significant, was revealed by the X-ray analysis to have underlying elements that the artist painted over. Vermeer was obsessive about getting his pictures exactly right, and so very often he painted out elements and replaced them with others. Painting number one shows no overpainting. I think painting number two is the original. And the picture we have hung in the National for 16 years is a forgery. A babble of voices. You can't believe that. Or perhaps a young artist, not yet proficient in his craft. We have a clear chain of ownership going all the way back to Peter von Reuven. The scientific evidence. The lack of aging. In the end, Glenwood's was the only dissenting voice. He was a Vermeer expert, but not a forgery expert, and not the director of the National Gallery. The painting that had mysteriously appeared would be banished to basement storage, so that no one else would be fooled into paying some exorbitant sum for it. And the one that had hung in the museum for 16 years would continue to hang there. It had been declared the real thing. 2270. The physicists spent 6 days trying to fix the square. Finally, they gave up, because they can't find any indicator that it is actually broken. Cran, who knows that it is not, insists over and over that the square simply went dark. For 6 days he holds his breath, not knowing what might happen. There are now two versions of the Vermeer loose in the time stream. What if that turns out to be so significant that something terrible happens to the present? Nothing does. Scientists and engineers wait for something, anything, to appear in Square Two. On the sixth day, something does. A crude Paleolithic figurine. Everyone goes crazy. This is the oldest piece of art the Squares have ever found. The expert on Stone Age art is summoned. The director is summoned. The stone figurine is replaced with a lump of rock. No transfer this early will disturb the time stream, not even if it's witnessed. The transfer will just be attributed to gods or magic or witchcraft. The fertility carving is reverently taken to the gallery. Toasts are drunk. The past is being recovered. The square works fine. All is well. Cran's chest expands as he finally breathes normally. As he leaves, the chief physicist gives Cran a long, hard look. A few days later, Cran goes to the gallery to attend the presentation of Tullia's painting. It is so beautiful that his heart aches. The picture is neither abstract nor mimetic, but rather something of both. What moves Cran so much is the way she has painted light. It is always the use of light that he cares about, and Tullia has captured starlight on human figures in a way he has never seen done before. The light, and not their facial expressions, seems to indicate the mood of each of her three human subjects, although so subtly that it does not feel forced. The emotion feels real. Everything about the painting feels real. The woman behind him says, "I'm pretty, yes, but actually it's just an exercise in an archaic and irrelevant art. Flat painting in a hollow age? I mean, who cares?" Gran wants to slug her. He does not. He congratulates Tullia, forcing words past the tightening in his throat, and leaves. At home he can't sleep. He is agitated, dispirited, depressed. No, he is jealous, so jealous that his skin burns and his head feels as if it might explode. He hates himself for his jealousy, but he can't help it. It drives him to pace, to almost, but not quite, cry out in the silence of his room. He can't sit still. In the middle of the night, he takes the underground tram to the project dome. No one is here. Constant attendance isn't required. When a square glows, it keeps on glowing until someone makes a transfer. One of the squares is glowing now. Inside is the image of Lady sewing a child's bonnet. Cran is not really surprised. Previously, the square had found, through the obscure mathematics of chaos, a strange attractor linked to this Vermeer. Once found, there was a strong chance it would find it again. But which picture is this, the original or Tullia's forgery? It is the original. He knows. The judgment isn't reasoned. It doesn't have to be. Cran knows, and he is prepared. From a closet, he takes one of his own pictures. The same size and shape as the Vermeer. It's a portrait of Tullia, painted from memory and so bad that no one else has ever seen it. The Vermeer in the square is surrounded by a wooden crate in darkness. Someone has, for whatever reason, boxed it up and stored it. Maybe it will be missed, maybe not. It no longer matters to him. All his movements are frenzied, almost spastic. Some small part of his mind thinks, "I am not sane." That doesn't matter either. Only once before has he felt like this, when he was very young and in love for the first and only time. He thought then, "If I don't touch her, I will die." He doesn't think that now, but he feels it deeper than thought, in his very viscera. This must be what Vermeer felt when he painted the picture, alone in his studio, consumed from the inside. It is the link between them. Cran makes the transfer. His dreadful painting disappears. Cran lifts Lady Sewing a Child's Bonnet, not an image, the real thing, from the square. For a long time he just holds it, drinking it in until the painting grows too heavy and his eyes too dimmed with tears. His plan is to box it into the same container in which he brought in his own painting. Cran has done research in the library database. He was careful to have a printer create four of Vermeer's signature pigments: natural ultramarine, verdigris, yellow ochre, lead white. And that is what the security scanner will identify and match with the package he brought in. He will have the Vermeer in his own room where no one ever goes, not even Tullia. He has done it. The door opens and the director comes in. "Cran, you couldn't sleep either.
Such a wonderful presentation of Tullia's life in Starlight. It made me want to come over and see what else the project might have.
Good Lord! Is that a Vermeer?
The director, whose specialty is Tang Dynasty pottery, but of course has a broad knowledge of art history, squints at the painting. All the frenzy has left Cran. He is cold as the lunar surface. The data screen behind him says, Transfer 655. Transfer date Tuesday, Decade 29, 2270. Transfer to past. Plan transfer from present to March 31st, 2018. Achieved transfer from present to March 31st, 2018. Status, transfer successful. Transfer to present. Plan transfer from March 31st, 2018 to present. Achieved transfer from March 31st, 2018 to present. Status, transfer successfully completed.
Yes, he says, a Vermeer. It just came through from the 20th century. I sent back a forgery. But I think this one is a forgery, too. Look, does it appear aged enough to you?
A commission is assembled. They examine the painting, but not for very long. Ladies sewing a child's bonnet was painted, the database says, in 1664. If it had come naturally through time to 2018, it would be 354 years old. Scientific examination shows it to be less than 10 years old. Yes, Cran thinks. 4 years from 1664 to 1668, plus a few weeks spent in 2018. Yes. On the scientific evidence, the painting is declared a forgery. A skillful copy, but a copy nonetheless. It isn't the first time the project scanners have targeted a forgery. Previously, however, that had only happened with sculptures, particularly Greek and Roman. We already tried once for the original, says the director, and got this. It would be too dangerous to the time stream to try again, I think, even if the original turns up in a square. Given the math, that might happen. The head physicist stares hard at Cran. Cran has already been removed from the project for failing to file clearances, which he has explained with the memory lapses of age. I'm getting them far more frequently now. He will never be allowed near a square again. A handler says, What shall I do with this forgery? The director is bleak with disappointment. It's useless to us now. Cran says humbly, May I have it? Oh, why not? Take it if you like fakery. Thank you, Cran says. He hangs the Vermeer on the wall of his room. The sad lady sewing a bonnet, disappointed in her life. The broken toy, flung aside pearls, drooping head, of course she is disappointed, glows in unearthly beauty. Cran spends an entire hour just gazing at the painting. When there is a knock on his door, he doesn't jump. The picture is legitimately his. It is Tullia.
Cran, I heard that...
She stops cold. Cran turns slowly. Tullia is staring at the picture, and she knows. Cran understands that. He understands too late that she is the one person who would know. Why didn't he think of this? He says, Tullia, that's not a forgery.
Yes, it is a skillful one, but... They did forensic tests. It's not even 10 years old. Not aged enough to...
I don't care. That's not a copy. Not even one by a forger better than I am. That's the original Vermeer.
No, Cran says desperately.
But Tullia has stepped closer to the painting and is examining every detail. Seeing things he cannot, could never learn to see. She knows. He debases himself to plead.
Tullia, you're an artist, the real thing. For centuries to come, people will be collecting and cherishing your work. I am nothing, please. Leave me this, please.
She doesn't even look at him. Her eyes never leave the painting.
I'm an old man. You can tell them the truth after I'm dead, but please, for now, let me have this. Please.
After an eon, she nods, just once, still not looking at him. She leaves the room. Cran knows she will never speak to him again. But she won't tell. He turns back to the Vermeer, drinking in the artistry, the emotion, the humanity. 1672. Johannes walked through the square beside the Hague toward the water. In a few minutes he would go inside. They could wait for him a few minutes longer. He studied the reflection of the stone castle, over 400 years old, in the still waters of the Hofweiver. The soft light of a May morning gives the reflected Hague a shimmer that the actual government building did not have. He came here to judge 12 paintings. They originally belonged to a great collector, Gerrit Reinst, who died 14 years ago by drowning in the canal in front of his own house. Johannes couldn't imagine how that had happened, but since then the collection had known nothing but chaos. Parts of it had been sold, parts gifted to the King of England, parts bequeathed to various relatives. A noted art dealer offered 12 of the paintings to Friedrich Wilhelm, Grand Elector of Brandenburg, who at first accepted them. Then the Grand Elector's art advisor said the pictures were forgeries and should be sent back. The art dealer refused to accept them. They now hung in the Hague, while 35 painters, 35, gave learned opinions on the picture's authenticity. One will be Vermeer. He was curious to see the paintings. They were all attributed to great masters, including Michelangelo, Titian, Tintoretto, Holbein. Vermeer, who had never left the Netherlands, would not have another chance to see such works, if they were genuine. Opinions so far had been divided. It was sometimes difficult to distinguish copies from the originals. Consider, for instance, his own Lady Sewing a Child's Bonnet. He hadn't thought about that picture in years. Always his intensity centered on what he was painting now. That, and on his growing impossible debts. He was being paid for this opinion, or he could not have afforded the trip to give it. A skilled forger could fool almost everyone. Johannes, who seldom left Delft, and had seen so few Italian paintings, was not even sure that he would be able to tell the difference between a forged Titian and an original, unless the copy was very bad. And a good forgery often gave its owners the same pleasure as the original. Still, he would try. Deceivers should not be able to replace the real thing with imitations. Truth mattered. But first he lingered by the Hofweiver, studying the shifting light on the water.